proceed to the last case of the morning. Still morning. United States versus Conrad, 10-2001. For Mr. Conrad, Mr. Brindley.
May it please the court. I represent the defendant appellant David Conrad. Mr. Conrad appeals the district court's decision finding that a confession and evidence obtained at the Chicago apartment noted in the briefing was attenuated from a Fourth Amendment violation that occurred at the Geneva residence of his parents. I want to address that attenuation argument, particularly the issue of the intervening event. And I think the most important thing to consider, and the one thing that really distinguishes Mr. Conrad's situation from all of the ones cited by the government, is the fact that Mr. Conrad, the evidence that they got at the Chicago apartment was computers containing the child pornography and a confession. 15 minutes from the Fourth Amendment violation, he told them he had those computers and he promised to give them to them. 2 minutes from the Fourth Amendment violation, he gave them that confession. Everything that happened at the Chicago apartment, everything that happened after that, was him retrieving what he already promised to give them immediately after the Fourth Amendment violation and repeating what he said to them immediately after the Fourth Amendment violation. Even the district court said, you cannot causally sever what happened there when he promised to go give them these things or he made this confession at Geneva. You cannot sever those from the Fourth Amendment violation. It's the immediate product. And the thing that makes this case different than the other cases the government cites is they have no case where the actual evidence that's supposed to be attenuated was given to them, told it was there, promised to be given them immediately after the Fourth Amendment violation. When that happens, you can't causally sever the retrieval of the evidence and the repetition of the confession from the promise to give it when that promise is the direct result of the Fourth Amendment violation. The government's principal case is Fazio. And the Fazio case is just different. And the first reason it's different, and maybe the most important reason, is the evidence that Fazio gave them that they claimed was attenuated was about cocaine trafficking. At the time of the Fourth Amendment violation, Fazio said nothing about that. He didn't give them any of that evidence. His decision to talk about cocaine trafficking was completely distinct from the time of the Fourth Amendment violation. That's totally different than here. Mr. Conrad told them about the computers and said, I'll give them to you, when he was there in the midst of the Fourth Amendment violation just minutes afterwards. He confessed then, and then he repeated it later, and he went to retrieve this stuff later, and you can't causally separate that. Fazio didn't have that. His decision to talk about cocaine had nothing to do with what he said to them right after the Fourth Amendment violation. The only kind of event that could intervene here to sever the causal connection would be one that either, one, gave Mr. Conrad an independent reason for giving him these computers or repeating this confession, other than the fact that he already promised it and already did it, or two, an event that gave him the opportunity to reflect outside the presence of law enforcement, make an independent decision to reinitiate contact. And that didn't happen here. The way that this happened in Fazio, he was allowed to get in his car, even though he hadn't said any of that stuff about the cocaine. That wasn't even an issue on his mind. He got to get in his car and make his own decision. And this court, Judge Rovner and Reed, I believe, noted that fact. But here, Mr. Conrad didn't have that opportunity. This was seamless. The car ride that the district court side and the government talked about was an extension, a direct extension of the promise to give them these computers and to repeat this confession. There's no way it can be disconnected. It's the process of retrieval, what he's already promised, in the immediate aftermath of the violation. And so for that reason, that can't be an intervening event. The phone call to his father is momentary, according to Sergeant Zagliffa. And that phone call didn't do anything to change the course of events. You have to have an event that severs the causal connection. Nothing changed the course of events. He promised to go get them the computers, and they took him to do it. He already made the confession. He was going to repeat it. That phone call did nothing. And in Taylor, the defendant actually got to talk to his family in person, and that didn't constitute an intervening event. And so For that reason,
isn't the content of the phone call important? His father told him, don't talk to them, didn't he?
His father indicated that he did, and he indicated that his son said, it's too late. That's what the father said. Sergeant Zagliffa remembered the call differently about what Mr. Conrad said. But when Mr. Conrad says it's too late, I think that suggests that it's because he's already promised. He's already given up the store. So yes, the content of the phone call could matter, but here what the content of the phone call is, according to Roger Conrad that you're referencing, Judge, is that David said that it was too late. And that means that he'd already told them, he made the promise.
But what did the officer say he said? He didn't say it was too late, did he?
I don't recall specifically, Judge, what the officer said. He said it was a momentary conversation, is what Sergeant Zagliffa said, as I recall it. But the content of the conversation might matter, but it can't sever the it did not give him a situation that would change the fact in any way that he'd already promised to do this. He'd already made his confession. Once he'd done that, there was really no reason for him to go back. No defendant in that situation would think, well, going back on it's going to be in my best interest. And the thing that he wasn't going back on is the thing that happened in the immediate aftermath of the violation. And none of these events that the government cites, whether he looked at some music equipment or changed the cat litter, those are the other two, they don't change the fact that the decision, the promise to give these things, and the confession happened just minutes after. And that's why there can't be an intervening event in this case. That's why this case is unlike any other. There's no case anywhere where within minutes of the violation, the very evidence they claim was attenuated is provided. It's told to the agents. There's no such case. Because if that's the case, you can't sever the causal connection. The second thing that I want to address is the issue of the purpose and flagrancy prong. And in Reed, Judge Rovner laid out the meaning of the purpose and flagrancy prong. And what that said was that when you go in as agents and your purpose when you commit the violation is investigative, to go in a fishing expedition to find evidence, and then you find the very evidence at the end, you get the very evidence you went in there looking for, you can't get attenuation. That's what we're trying to prevent. Here, that's where they were. They were at ground. They had nothing. They went to the machine shop. They had nothing. Then they go to the house. They had to find something there. If they didn't, the cat was out of the bag. They'd already been to the machine shop. And so were they on a fishing expedition? Yes. And they said specifically they were trying to get statement from Mr. Conrad and evidence from Mr. Conrad. They got exactly what they wanted by way of the Fourth Amendment violation. And to allow them to then use that is to allow them to benefit from it in the way the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule are supposed to prevent. Moreover, the district court found that the purpose and flagrancy prong favored suppression because she suppressed at Geneva on that basis. What she said was, well, they went in for investigative purpose, so under Reed, at Geneva, yes, it should be suppressed. But later they had a good reason when they went in the Chicago apartment, so they weren't on a fishing expedition anymore. With respect to the district court, the reason was because they'd committed the violation and they got the information. What that sort of suggests is if you commit a violation for the purpose of getting a certain kind of evidence or fruit, as we might say, it might be poisonous there, but if you take it and go somewhere else and use it to get more of the exact same evidence, in fact, the exact same evidence that was promised there, then it's okay to cook with the fruit. And that's not how the exclusionary rule works. It can't be done that way.
Your rebuttal time.
I understand, Judge. And with that, I will reserve whatever time I have left, Judge. Thank you.
Good. And Mr. Thompson.
May it please the Court, Joe Thompson on behalf of the United States. The district court did not err in denying defendant's motion to suppress the statements of evidence obtained at the defendant's Chicago apartment. The first thing I want to focus on is the nature of the violation itself here. This was a curtilage violation that occurred at the Geneva residence. It wasn't an illegal entry into the residence. It wasn't an illegal search of that residence. And it wasn't an illegal seizure of the defendant. So the question here is whether the statements and evidence obtained at the Chicago apartment were sufficiently attenuated from the curtilage violation at the defendant's parents' Geneva residence. And this is important, Your Honors, because the defendant is suggesting that the stuff that happened inside of the apartment and after the curtilage violation can't be considered as part of the attenuation analysis. But that's not true. That stuff can be considered as part of the attenuation analysis. There's nothing wrong with the defendant's agreement to cooperate with agents and agreements to travel with agents to his Chicago apartment. There's nothing wrong with that. It was suppressed as the fruit of the curtilage violation, not because that was involuntary or the defendant was in custody or something that it was during an ongoing Fourth Amendment violation. It didn't. It was suppressed as the fruit. And that was the court trying to draft come up with an appropriate remedy for the earlier curtilage violation under the fruit doctrine. And that's what the court did. The important thing here is the attenuation analysis that the court conducted here is distinct from the ones that the defendant cites, which involved ongoing illegal seizures. And the court defense talks about in its briefs about cases where there's an illegal seizure that's ongoing and Miranda and other things can't cure it. There's no attenuation there. This is different. It was a curtilage violation. After the curtilage violation, things started to happen that attenuated the curtilage violation. By the time they got to the Chicago apartment, it attenuated that from the earlier curtilage violation. The first step of that is the defendant's own voluntary agreement to cooperate with agents, to travel with them to his apartment in Chicago. That was a voluntary agreement by the defendant, and that was something that he could have said no to. As the district court found, the police, our agents were acted professionally. They were not coercive. And the defendant voluntarily agreed to do that, to travel with agents, to go with agents. Judge Magnus Stinson noted, during the car ride, the defendant talked to his father. And in fact, the district court made findings about what happened in that conversation. This is on page 9 of the trial court's opinion. The court found that during their telephone conversation, Roger Conrad, the defendant's father, told his son not to talk to the officers. According to Sergeant Zaglifa's credible testimony, defendant responded that, quote, it's no problem. That's what happened during the car ride. And again, that's a car ride during which the defendant was not in custody. And he was going voluntarily with officers. As the district court found, it was not a coercive environment. During that car ride, he was able to use his own cell phone. He talked to his father on the phone, and his father said, son, don't talk to the police. Don't do this. And the defendant, again, made a choice consistent with what he had been doing all along and what he continued to do throughout the day. He wanted to cooperate with the police and dad, it's no problem. I got this out of control. That's a significant attenuating factor, Your Honor. Moving forward, upon arrival at the defendant's apartment in Chicago, this now about two hours later from the earlier curtilage violation, the defendant, again, not in custody, in a non-coercive environment where agents are acting professionally, the defendant agreed to talk with agents. He signed that he orally waived his Miranda rights. He waived his Miranda rights in writing. He signed a written consent to search, and again, continued to cooperate with agents. These are the factors, Your Honors, that attenuated the evidence and statements that were acquired at his apartment, all these factors, from the curtilage violation 2 hours earlier at his parents' house in Geneva, Illinois. Moving back a little bit to the initial decision by the defendant to leave, to travel voluntarily with agents, I think it's important to know, as the district court found, officers told the defendant he didn't have to go with them. He wasn't in custody. He did not have to travel with them. But he voluntarily decided he wanted to. These are all factors that attenuated the earlier curtilage violation from the evidence later obtained at the defendant's apartment. Next, Your Honor, defendant has raised the issue of the flagrancy, the purpose and flagrancy of the violation in this case. It's true that the district court found that the officers did intend to interview the defendant at his parents' house. That's why they were there. But it's important to know that the district court found that the defendants or the agents were not flagrant in their violation. In fact, the court found that their actions in going out to the deck, the back deck of the house, actually fell within a recognized exception to the curtilage rule that's been recognized by many circuits, not by this circuit, but by other ones. And in fact, the agents weren't acting surreptitiously. They may have made a mistake, but it was an honest mistake. In fact, they were on the phone with the defendant's father talking to him about having been on the deck and what they saw there. They weren't doing this surreptitiously. This is nothing nefarious. They made a mistake, but they didn't do so flagrantly. And the district court, in fact, considered this and considered the fact that while they were trying to interview the defendant, they were not flagrant. And the court concluded that was one factor, but one that did not weigh in favor of suppression with respect to the evidence and statements obtained at the defendant's apartment in Chicago. Unless the court has any further questions, I would ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Brindley.
Mr.
Brinley, I meant to ask you, didn't law enforcement know of the existence of this other apartment or the Chicago apartment before they went into the Geneva house?
No, they did not. They did not. They learned that there, Judge. They learned that after they got in, right after the violation.
All right.
Responding to what the government said about the phone call to his father, part of the problem here is the father says that he said it was too late, and we're sort of crediting half of what he says and half of what Zagliffa says. I think that's hard. But on top of that, it doesn't matter. If he says it's no problem, at that point, he's already given them everything. He's told them what the evidence is, and you can't sever causally anything by way of a phone call, because it doesn't change that. It doesn't change the course of anything. It can't. With respect to the flagrancy, the Reed court said here in this circuit specifically, it's not just bad faith of the officers. If they go in for an investigative purpose and they get what they're looking for, they can't exploit it. You can't have attenuation. And I submit what they did in this case would not actually be acceptable in any circuit. What the court found was they had to go up on the deck, and then they had to lean over or possibly climb on a railing to peer into a window that's not visible to any public person. And that's the kind of private space. There's nowhere where that's going to be acceptable. That's the very thing the Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect. And so for that reason, the purpose and flagrancy prong, as the court found, favors suppression, as it did in Geneva, and it's no different in terms of the purpose when you consider what happened at the apartment in Chicago. And for those reasons, we would ask that it be reversed, Judge.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brinley, and both counsel. That case will go under advisement as well. And court.